Welcome back to On the Middle East, On Monitor's conversation with thought leaders on the big stories in the region. My name is Ambrin Zaman, and I'm lucky to have as my guest today Esther Solomon, editor-in-chief of the gutsy liberal Israeli daily Haaretz English. Esther and I discuss the latest developments in the conflict in Gaza as it enters its third month with ever deadlier twists. Most notable among them is the assassination, likely by Israel, of Hamas's number two man, Saleh al-Arouri, in Lebanon, where he was offered haven by the powerful Iran-backed Shia militia, Hezbollah. Just as our conversation unfolded, an attack on the tomb of the late IRGC al-Quds Force commander, Qasem Soleimani, in the southeastern Iranian city of Kerman, left over at least 103 people dead, adding to the spiral of violence which is threatening to engulf the region. Esther, welcome to our program. Thank you for making the time. I know how very busy you are at the moment.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
So, have we entered a new phase of this conflict with the assassination of Arouri in Lebanon? And what are the ramifications of this?
Well, we're certainly still in the waiting period to see what is actually going to happen. Definitely what happened yesterday, 6 o'clock in the afternoon, threw up the cards somewhat. The question, it was obviously an opportunity that Israel's intelligence and defense agencies decided was too good to miss, after they had said from October the 7th onwards that basically all senior Hamas officials, whether they're in Gaza or outside, were basically dead men walking. So that was a decision that they must have taken because of intelligence that they were there in Beirut, without other civilians around, and it was just an opportunity that they had to take. Now, obviously, it's a major issue for Hezbollah now, who has been conducting a kind of deliberately low-level campaign, not quite moving into outright war with Israel on its northern border ever since October the 7th. And Hezbollah have a lot of reasons not to want to escalate, although they have the issue of wanting and needing to show that they have some kind of response to the fact that this hit happened on their home turf. It couldn't have been closer to home. And, you know, the Hezbollah chief Nasrallah is speaking just in a few hours. His speeches are often very long, and without specific content, but you know there are noises that some kind of retaliation will take place, but it's not very clear that Lebanon wants that kind of escalation into war, because it's obviously Lebanon that will pay the price as well. But there's other issues as well, which is, you know, obviously Iran has a clear part in all of this, whether now is the time for that kind of escalation. Hezbollah is always, you know, one of their key proxy cards, and they may well want to keep that powder dry for now. It's not necessarily exactly now that they want everything to go, I won't say nuclear, but certainly more extreme than it is now. On the other hand, Israel is still facing this, you know, constant basically turning into a war of attrition on its northern border, and there are noisier and noisier voices within Israel that more must be done against Hezbollah.
Well, there is always that sort of conspiracy theory, if that's what you want to call it, out there, claiming that Israel actually wants to bait Iran into this war and wants the Americans, of course, to rise to their defense.
Yeah, but the same kind of conspiracy theory could be said about and has been already constructed about the beginning of this war with Hamas as well, that Israel put down its defenses in order for Hamas to strike and therefore give grounds for Israel to destroy Gaza. This is really very much in the realm of very malign conspiracy theories indeed.
So you don't believe that Israel is interested in conflict with Iran?
No, definitely. I don't think that Israel would invite a conflict that would create enormous destruction, not at this point, certainly. I mean, Israel kind of holds to itself the right to ensure that Iran doesn't become a nuclear threat. Now, Iran is creeping pretty close towards that, but I don't think Israel has made the assessment that it is so imminent that it must be stopped right now.
And so what we can fully expect in that case is Israel doing what it says it will do, which is to go after the Hamas leadership and presumably the leader Sinwar, who's thought to be in Khan Yunis in Gaza. So a lot of effort concentrated on that, while I guess the clashes will continue on the ground in Gaza too. But at the same time, obviously, international pressure mounting on Israel. How has this killing of Aruri reverberated across Israel? Has it been a boost for Netanyahu, who is admittedly under quite a bit of pressure domestically?
Well, a boost for Netanyahu, I'm sure that Israel traditionally does not take direct responsibility for foreign assassinations of this kind, so he can't exactly use it in an election, in a re-election advert. But his popularity ratings are so low that pretty much any democratically elected leader seeing them would, want to run away somewhere or hide their head in the sand. But, they are so low that, an achievement, let's say, of this kind is not going to make any difference for that. And I think it also raises the fundamental distinction that there is at the moment that generally there is significant national consensus in terms of the war on Hamas, but there is absolutely approaching single digit figures confidence in the prime minister.
So just for our audience to understand, on the one hand, of course, there is this anger that his government failed to foresee this attack and to take necessary measures to prevent it. But on the other hand, is it fair to say that no matter who would have been leading Israel at this time, had such an attack occurred, the response would have been pretty much the same, that this is really existential for Israel, and that's a sort of broadly held consensus in Israeli politics society?
Yes, I think that apart from parties more on the hard left and some of the Arab Jewish parties, there is definitely consensus that the attack on October the 7th would require, a massive response that would in some ways try and reestablish deterrence and to ensure that there is no going back to the status quo, because the status quo basically means the capacity of Hamas to do another October the 7th. So yes, I think that there is there isn't a huge spectrum of debate, but there is growing debate about the extent of the damage and loss of lives in Gaza. And there is a very, very strong public campaign by the families of the hostages that are still being held in by Hamas in Gaza, saying that the bombardments endanger those hostages, the lack of a ceasefire endangers those hostages, and extraterritorial maneuvers and assassinations by Israel certainly doesn't help their family members come home either. Not to forget that Al-Aruri was, quite a key figure in some of these, in the latest round of ceasefire negotiations.
Of course, the sort of irony is that he was also, as you said, a key figure in those negotiations. So does him dying sort of put them in peril? I mean, where do we go from here? What do you foresee? What awaits Israel?
Well, that's quite a frightening question. I don't really put myself out as a prophet, but at the moment, since his assassination, the ceasefire talks are formally on hold. Now, bearing in mind there's the public narrative and there's what's actually happening behind the scenes, I couldn't actually say if that actually means that there really isn't dialogue going on, because there's dialogue going on so many, in so many different geographical locations and on different levels. We know, you know, in Egypt, in Qatar, in various European cities as well. I find it hard to believe that there is a complete freeze on anything. On the other hand, we still don't know what the Hamas response, Islamic Jihad, Hezbollah responses will be. But there does certainly, I mean, the reason that Hamas was in any way interested in a ceasefire still holds, that they want some kind of time out to assess their losses and stop the active warfare for a bit.
Another paradox of this conflict is the fact that none of the countries with which Israel, you know, established diplomatic relations, I mean, UAE, Bahrain, etc., have really had any beef in this, any role, whereas Qatar, who's been holding out, has had an outsized role. What does this say about the future of these efforts to normalize with, you know, neighbors? And what's the takeaway? Have these Abraham Accords been good for Israel? Or maybe the opposite, that they maybe help spur or accelerate this attack?
Well, I'm not sure if they help spur it, but really, listen, a clear part of the reasoning behind the Abraham Accords, especially for Netanyahu, but also on the part of the Gulf countries in question, was a way of bypassing or sidelining the Palestinian question. And, you know, all sides, without some with nicer words, or, you know, we do care, or we'll deal with that. We're going into this alliance so that we can have more leverage over Israel. I mean, really, in practice, nothing much of that happened during the time that the Abraham Accords were beginning in since. But to say that it's had no impact since October the 7th, yes, okay, there have been strongly worded denunciations. There have been ambassadors who've been recalled for talks. But if you compare what you would have predicted the Gulf reaction to have been in the absence of the Abraham Accords and how they have been now, I think there is a significant difference. You know, there's still talk that Saudi Arabia might still be interested in coming to some kind of agreement with Israel, which seems difficult to imagine now. But, you know, the reasons that these countries went into the Abraham Accords were extremely cold and pragmatic. And it's all to do with, you know, post-oil economies. It's to do with Iran. It's to do with, you know, a whole spectrum of things, not only, and not really including the Palestinians. Yes, what has happened now? The Israel-Hamas war has made the Palestinian issue erupt onto world headlines. And, you know, saying we can't, this issue has been sidelined for too long, and it doesn't just go away because you're not talking about it. But on the other hand, those cold pragmatic reasons for the Abraham Accords still exist. And I think that in a strange way, this war has shown that they are, they have some stamina.
That's probably true, but still there's so many moving parts to this, where you have Saudi Arabia trying to make peace in Yemen, and that being jeopardized by what's going on with the Houthis attacking these ships, commercial vessels in the Red
Sea. On the other hand, the Saudis have knocked down some of their missiles and that have been launched. So
going towards Israel, even. So that's also quite interesting and speaks to what you said about the durability and the potential for the Abraham Accords to sort of be consolidated.
Right. Although the kind of trans-regional defense understandings, if not agreements, you know, have existed and do exist independently of actually official normalization.
Turning back again to Israel and your newspaper, it's come under a lot of criticism for its stance on covering this war, and has traditionally, in fact, certainly from our very right-wing circles, and with the communications minister accusing you of sabotaging Israel in wartime. Are you under a lot of pressure, and how does it manifest itself?
Well, on the one hand, Haaretz is used to being a bit of a lone voice, if not a lonely voice, because from a much more diverse media landscape, we're pretty much the only newspaper that proudly pins the word liberal democracy and two-state solution and anti-occupation to its mast. So, you know, there used to be more space for that, and now we inhabit most of that space. On the other hand, we also recognize that the government is interested in inciting against both those values and against us in particular. So yes, that was very unpleasant when the minister in charge of communications made threats against us, but we haven't felt any tangible threats in terms of our freedom to operate. On the other, you know, in some ways, especially for the far right, but also for the right wing in this government, we're a useful straw man for them that they can always use to spar against. So I'm sure they would miss us if we weren't here.
But have any of your reporters been threatened with violence? I mean, I'm not just talking about government pressure, but, you know, any nasty public reaction?
I would say that there was more civil threats of violence in the air during the pro-democracy protest movement, which obviously came to a pretty sudden end on October the 7th, because that was a period where it really felt like Israel was about to slide into civil war, and the smell of violence in the air was getting stronger and stronger, also from the police and also from right wings on the streets. Now I don't see immediately at this point that that's a major threat.
Finally, I mean, after October 7th and that masthead, do you still believe in it? Do you still believe it's realistic? I would ask you personally, how are you sort of coming to terms with everything you believed in the aftermath of all these awful things that have happened and continue to happen?
That's a very hard question. And I'm not sure that anyone who can give a very complete and eloquent answer to it has really thought it through, I have to say. I think that on the one hand, there is no doubt that people who put enormous faith in building peace from the grassroots upwards have suffered a huge blow, because it was many of those people themselves who were targeted by Hamas in the kibbutzim on Israel's border. And not just because of that, in a more meta way, the idea that there is going to be any kind of broad public support for compromise seems very far away. On the other hand, we know from history, sometimes enormous shocks can lead to a realignment of political and social forces. So if I didn't have some kind of optimism, it would be very hard to start each day afresh. And listen, quite practically, Israel has this extraordinarily intense military campaign in Gaza. But right from the start, the question that was not sufficiently answered, but the United States is and others are demanding an answer to more and more, is what's going to happen afterwards. And that what happens afterwards necessarily involves some kind of rethinking of political solution. You know, I would hope that that could be some kind of spur towards much more serious discussions about a two-state solution, but it's going to require very sensitive and clever packaging for the majority of Israelis who are somewhere in the center. And it will obviously be confronted with very, very noisy opposition from the right and the far right, many of whom sit in this current government.
But it's fair to say that the status quo October 7th ante was just not a sustainable one.
We were saying that for a lot of time, that there is no such thing as a status quo. Things don't just, you know, there is no such thing as everyone just living in some kind of frozen animation. Things were, you know, there was a deterioration of living conditions of all kinds of issues on the West Bank. Also, there was a deterioration in terms of Palestinian rights and lives. So there is absolutely no way that any Israeli government could survive by pushing the idea that things will go back to where they were. In fact, you know, that's against the stated aims of the war itself. Unfortunately, in terms of a vision for what that would mean, Netanyahu is not the person who is ever going to be able to offer something like that.
I guess the greatest hope going forward, and people get very upset with me when I say this, particularly since October 7th, that for better or for worse, Israel is a democracy. And we saw that in play again on January 1st when the higher courts struck down that effort to curb its powers that were, you know, being pushed by Netanyahu to protect himself. So,
I mean, it was a very bittersweet moment for all of us, because we had been obviously following the pro-democracy movement and this specific Supreme Court judgment, you know, day by day, hour by hour. And then the war happened, and then suddenly, just days ago, we heard that the judgment was going to be handed down. And really, it was a smack across the face for Netanyahu and all the would-be authoritarians in his government, and their attempt to defang the Supreme Court, its capacity to conduct judicial review, which all sounds very dry, but actually has quite dramatic, it would have had very dramatic impact on the lives of all the citizens of Israel and of Palestinians as well in the West Bank. So, yes, it was a moment of satisfaction, but it's very difficult to find any satisfaction, really, in a true sense, at a time of war.
Well, thank you so much for being with us today, and stay safe, and hopefully we'll speak in more peaceful times very soon.
I hope for that too.
Thank you. And this brings us to the end of this episode of On the Middle East. I wish all of you a very happy, healthy, and hopefully peaceful new year. Don't forget to check out our website, www.al-monitor.com, for in-depth coverage of the Middle East.
Thank you and goodbye.